Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to feel like a grown-up? Many of us might think back to getting our first real jobs, moving out of our parents' homes, or getting married and starting families as events that launched our adult lives. But as my guest today has learned, those touchstones are often not available to today's working-class Americans in their mid-20s and early 30s. Instead of a vast array of appealing choices in the years following adolescence, many young people from blue-collar backgrounds see before them a less-than-hopeful future of just barely getting by. And that outlook affects everything from their educational achievements to their interest in committed relationships. Jennifer M. Silva is a postdoctoral fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School. Her new book is called Coming Up Short, Working Class Adulthood in an Age of Uncertainty. Jen, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much.
This subject was of interest to you professionally, but also personally. Will you tell us a little bit about your family history?
Sure. So I am a first-generation college student, and I come from a blue-collar background. My grandfather started off at age 8 working in a mill in Lowell, Massachusetts, which is famous for its industry. And then my dad and his brothers and sisters grew up in a suburb and took really stable blue-collar jobs like firefighting or police officers. And so as I grew up and I went off to college and grad school, I saw many of my cousins and close family friends starting to struggle, not really being sure if they could follow in the footsteps of their parents or if they should go to college, and not necessarily having the tools and skills they needed. So there was a personal interest as well as a professional one.
And the definitions of adulthood were once, it seems, pretty clear. You had a job, you were self-sufficient, you maybe had a family. Now it's harder to get to that stage unless you start from a really solid sort of middle-class position financially.
I think that's true. It seems that the institutions that once sort of propelled people into adulthood, whether schools helping people enter the workforce or communities or families that pushed people into marriage and child rearing, they don't seem to be working the same way. And so many of the young people I spoke with don't have a lot of guidance. They don't have people they can turn to. They don't really expect loyalty or help from work or education or family. And so they don't really know what it means to grow up anymore.
Tell us a little bit about the subjects that you chose for this research and the kinds of questions you asked about their lives in your interviews.
Sure. So I was interested in people who had grown up in blue-collar backgrounds, so who didn't have parents who had gone to college. And that's because I wanted to see kind of the people who are the most vulnerable in our service economy, maybe people who didn't grow up with internships and lots of activities and having the right connections to get ahead. And I found them by doing a lot of field work. I would go from service sector workplaces to fire stations, military training sites, fast food chains, gas stations, anything you can think of, the people you interact with in your daily life, and just going up to people and asking if they'd tell me their coming-of-age story. Hmm. And people were very willing to talk. They really felt like they wanted someone to hear what they had been through and how they were trying to live their lives. So I asked them about their family backgrounds. I asked them about their hopes and dreams for the future. I asked them about the hardest part of growing up. I asked them about education and debt and their dreams for having kids and their definition of a good marriage. Pretty broad array of questions.
One thing that's very interesting is that in this country, there was a time when a blue-collar job was not mutually exclusive from a middle-class job.
Yes, that's right. And many of them watched their parents and grandparents have jobs as firemen or factory workers, but still buy a house and support a family and go on a vacation. And all of a sudden, those jobs are not as available.
Hmm. And it's hard to find a job with just a high school education these days, let alone a job that one might expect to keep until retirement, which is another thing that has really changed.
Absolutely. So my respondents bounce from job to job. Maybe they'll be laid off from one, or they can't get enough hours at another, or maybe they can't afford transportation to a third. So it's just constant instability and insecurity in the labor market.
A lot of them seem to have in common this sense that they had a hard time growing up, and that maybe adulthood is simply about surviving childhood.
That's very true. Many of them grew up in families where their parents were also being kind of torn apart by the loss of good blue-collar jobs. And so they'd watch their parents' relationships falling apart. They'd see their communities weakening under the strain of economic insecurity. And so they kind of grew up feeling very isolated. And as they can't really move forward and they have trouble saying, oh, look what I did. I moved out. I got a job. I got a degree. Instead, they start to create these internal milestones and they start to base adulthood on having overcome these sort of painful personal pasts.
So in other words, there's no less need to see oneself as having emerged from childhood and become an adult. There's just because the old milestones aren't there, they have to fabricate is the wrong word, but they have to create narratives that allow them to believe they've achieved adulthood.
That's true. They're narratives of progress, but they're more emotional progress or internal progress.
I was really interested in how psychologically literate these individuals were, many of whom did not finish college or even go to college, but they're sort of well-versed in these ideas of self and personhood and self-esteem that we sort of once associated with a class that had a lot more disposable income.
I was shocked as well. So none of my interview questions concern these kind of psychological ideas. And so I was talking to people, and at the end of the interview, I would often say, have I missed anything? And then respondents would talk for another 45 minutes about their kind of psychological struggles that they'd been through. And it turns out that whether reading self-help books or maybe joining meetup groups online or participating in Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous or family support groups in schools, or even watching Oprah, they really are learning this psychological language of self-growth. And, you know, you can transform your life if you only work hard enough and believe you can do it.
Well, let's talk about that idea that hard work is really the core of things. I think most people, you know, on the surface of it sort of agree with that idea. One thing that you found that was interesting was that, for one thing, when they weren't doing well financially, they tended to blame themselves.
They did, and I was also a little surprised about that. I might have expected more anger towards institutions, and there was some of that too, but in the end, they really thought it was up to them to figure out what they were doing wrong and work harder and transform themselves. One woman said, no one's going to fix me but me. So they really do embrace this idea of American self-help and self-reliance.
Did they have a hard time asking for help when they needed it?
They did for two reasons. One is that they weren't always sure where to go for help. For example, if someone was having trouble filling out a financial aid form for college, they weren't always sure about how the bureaucracy worked or where they could go for help. Mm-hmm. And they also struggled because they weren't sure who they could trust. So many of them have had multiple experiences of what felt like betrayal, you know, whether they maybe got an associate's degree and couldn't figure out how to use their major to get a job, or maybe they got a job and they were laid off the next week and told not to expect any loyalty. So they're sort of afraid to ask for help because depending on other people hasn't worked out for them in the past.
And they also, you know, were not able to summon a lot of empathy for other people who were struggling.
That's true. One of the most disturbing findings is that I heard this attitude of, if I have to go it alone, everybody else should too. Sort of this idea of, well, if the government is going to help me, then why should you get the help? And that's because they link these ideas of self-reliance and self-help to self-worth and this idea that if you're a worthy person, if you're a good person, you can work your way up and save yourself. So they don't have a lot of empathy for those around them who can't do that.
How much confidence did they place in their own ability to fulfill the dreams that they had?
I think they sort of went back and forth. They would say almost as if trying to convince themselves, I know I can do it. I have to do it. There's no other choice. But then as we were talking, you know, it would become clear that they had a lot of debt or they were afraid of moving to a new city or you know, they weren't even sure how they were going to pay the rent that month or how they were going to get their car fixed. So as much as they want to believe that they can solve anything, they also understand the realities.
Okay, so you mentioned education earlier and that you had interviewed some people who had gone to college and in a couple of cases earned a degree and were still working, you know, pretty menial jobs that were, you know, just barely above minimum wage. These were really sad cases to me because these are individuals who sort of listened to what they were told in school, maybe by parents or clergy. They did all the right things and it's still not paying off for them.
That's true. They've grown up in this educational system that really pushes college for everyone. And as one young man told me, he grew up hearing that college was the land of milk and honey. So, you know, education would be the path to success. However, once these young men and women are in college, it turns out they lack a whole range of knowledge and skills and connections that help them navigate the system, whether it's learning how to get financial aid and not taking out, you know, massive private loans, or whether it's even distinguishing between a for-profit and not-for-profit school. And then later it's, you know, what do I major in and then how do I use that major to get a job? They don't really know the answers to these questions and they also don't know who to turn to for help.
Hmm. And a lot of them, whether or not they leave college with a degree, a great number of them are leaving with just a mound of student debt.
Just crippling debt, you know, tens of thousands of dollars in debt. And for the people who leave before they get the degree, it's especially tragic because they do this risk assessment and say, oh, I'm already $80,000 in debt. I can't go more into debt. So I should go back to working, selling coffee. And so then they have the debt and no degree.
All right. So anyone who has been through a really hard time financially can probably understand at a really gut level the stresses that that can place on your entire life. But for those fortunate enough not to have struggled in that way, can you talk about what you learned about why financial insecurity is so detrimental to personal relationships and in particular romantic relationships?
Definitely. So these men and women have this sense of, I can't keep my feet under me. They can't seem to make their lives stable or secure. And this affects relationships in different ways for men and women. So the men I spoke with still have these ideals of masculinity as providing for your family, taking care of a home, taking a woman out to eat and paying for dinner. And so they feel that without a stable job, there's sort of no point in pursuing monogamous relationships. So one man, Brandon, told me no woman wants to sit on the couch and eat Burger King, right? He can't afford to take her out. He can't afford to pay the bills. So what's the point of even trying? And that actually makes these men very sad. You know, they'll talk about how, you know, people used to get married and used to fall in love, and they feel like that has really passed them by.
And for then, women, how's it different for women?
So women, it's interesting because men have sort of lost what used to be, you know, these blue-collar jobs that would allow them to support a family. And women, on the other hand, are finding that, you know, they have to work and that they even have more opportunities than they would have a few generations ago. And so for women, you know, they feel like they have only themselves to depend on, and they kind of take pride in that. And they're almost afraid to depend on a man who might turn out to be unreliable. So, you know, one woman says, I'm going to be alone and fierce rather than depend on someone and lose myself. So
Jennifer M. Silva is my guest. She's a postdoctoral fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School, where she joins us. She joins us from Harvard today. And she is the author of a book called Coming Up Short, Working Class Adulthood in the Age of Uncertainty. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Jennifer M. Silva. She joins us from a studio on the campus of Harvard University, where she is a postdoctoral fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School. She's also author of the new book, Coming Up Short, Working Class Adulthood in an Age of Uncertainty. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Jen, you say that marriage has become more equitable but also more fragile for these young adults. What do you mean by that?
So when I talk about, I'm trying to talk about how the institution of marriage has changed in just a few generations. And in some ways, we can sort of celebrate the way that marriage has changed. Women have much more freedom. They can work. They can own property. They can take out lines of credit on their own. And also men and women can leave a relationship if it feels abusive or sterile or unfulfilling. And there's much more emphasis in marriage on equality between partners rather than maybe a man making decisions and money and women doing more caring work and not having as much power. So we see that marriage has in a way become more equitable. But at the same time, knowing that you can leave a marriage if you're unhappy has also made it very fragile. Hmm. And so people have to work to stay together because there's that option of leaving if you're unhappy. So it brings a sense of insecurity into a relationship.
Yeah, so the moment that it's not good for one or the other party, that's it.
Right, because now we expect marriage to be sort of fulfilling, to be full of communication, to allow both partners to grow emotionally. And so we have these very high expectations. It's not just about having a good enough marriage. We want this sort of amazing marriage. And if you're not getting that, you feel like you can go elsewhere.
How do these young adults look back at their parents' and grandparents' relationships in relation to their own? Do they look at grandma and say, okay, her marriage wasn't quite like what I'm expecting? Or do they say, well, she sold herself short?
Well, it's funny because there's sort of a gap between their ideals and what they have witnessed. Hmm. When they look at their own parents' relationships, usually these relationships were characterized by a lot of stress and turmoil because their parents were under a lot of economic strain. And, you know, maybe a father would be disabled at work and then couldn't support the family and the mother would leave. So they grew up seeing a lot of family turmoil. However, they have these very nostalgic or idealized images of what family should be. For example, men would say, oh, I always imagined I'd be sitting on a porch, you know, surrounded by a white picket fence, growing old with a woman I loved, or listening to the Dick Van Dyke Show with my, you know, love of my life. Hmm. And so they have this image that love should be forever and it should be with your soulmate. And they also have a sense that that's gone now.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Tom in Plano. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Chris. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question for the guest is, I'm wondering what her research shows as being the broader implications of these adults that have this stunted, emotionally stunted and psychologically stunted. What's the broader implication in the workforce? Because I currently work with some people that it seems to me they're very childlike and very immature, and it has sort of a negative impact. And I'm wondering, on a broader scale, what is that implication as far as the U.S. workforce goes? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
I can think of a few implications. One is that it's very hard for these young adults to think about or plan for a future when their present feels so unstable. So if they don't really know if they'll be bouncing from job to job or where they'll be living, it's really hard for them to make good decisions about the future. And I can see that making a difference in the workplace because it makes planning long-term or investing really difficult. They're much more likely to make short-term rather than long-term decisions. Another worry is that they are embracing a kind of ethos of isolation or individualism where they don't really trust others and want to do things on their own. And I think that could also be problematic for a workforce when people just want to go off and not invest in relationships with other people.
There's a really interesting parallel to what you were just explaining about relationships. I mean, job security, when we think about an insecure, insecure prospects for someone's employment, we typically think that they're going to, be laid off frequently. But it goes the other way, right? If a young person feels a job is not perfect and then decides to sort of hop across town and does that too often, the consequences ultimately are almost the same.
It's true. I think that they learn that there's no loyalty either way. Mm-hmm. And that sense of no loyalty extends into their personal relationships and also their broader social relationships.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Prakash in Arlington. Hi, Prakash.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, I was wondering, isn't it better at times to just get like a two-year associate degree at community college or get some type of a skill rather than going to a four-year university and then majoring in something where your parents are paying for your tuition and room and board, or maybe taking out a huge loan and then coming out at the end of 4 years and cannot get a job, and then kids end up living with their parents or like working at low-paying jobs. And so especially in this global era where we've got so much competition, and for an 18-year-old at times it's very hard, I think, to make a decision as to what. And they are all like starry-eyed and they want to major in certain major even though they might be really passionate about it.
Well, does that relate to the things that you spoke to your study subjects about, Jen?
So none of the men and women I spoke with could really rely on their parents to pay for college, but they certainly were taking out loans to pay for a four-year degree. And I completely agree. Some of them would major in, the general arts or criminal justice and then really have no idea how to envision a future using that degree. And part of the problem is that they don't know that you don't necessarily have to use your degree for your job. And so there's just this lack of general knowledge about how your credentials translate into the workforce that leaves people in a lot of debt and unsure about where to go. And I think you're right. I think it is a question of guidance and about getting people the skills and knowledge they need to compete in the labor force. And they are not getting that.
How does this sense of having, few choices in life, maybe an insecure future, play into the decisions these young adults are making about when and, frankly, if to start families, to become parents?
That's really interesting. So most of them are not in stable relationships. However, maybe about 25 of them did have children. And pregnancies were almost always accidental. So there wasn't much planning involved or looking ahead to the future. And at the same time, many of them didn't have good knowledge about healthcare or options. However, once they are pregnant or have children, their worldviews really shift and they start to tell this narrative of, I need to grow up and be better for my child. I need to, resolve my past issues. I need to deal with my, problems with my family, with my addiction histories, with my work history, and really turn my life around. So there's a sense of redemption through having children that many of the respondents expressed.
Were they meeting those goals that they set for themselves to sort of grow up and get on the straight and narrow path?
In some cases, they were, but in others, the institutions that almost are trying to help them often work against them. So, for example, one woman had a baby and she joined the National Guard because she thought it would pay for her to go to college and get a better job and give her son a better life. Mm-hmm. However, she was also working full time at a service job, so she never had time to take classes. And then she ended up being deployed twice, which was great for saving money, but it also meant that she left her son and came back with PTSD and had a lot of guilt. And so it's kind of like one step forward, two steps back. They're trying to give their kids a better life, but they feel like they never quite get there.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number if you'd like to ask a question or maybe tell a story about your own experiences with coming of age as a young adult from the working class. Let's go next on the phone to Andre in Dallas. Hello, Andre.
Hello. Myself, I'm a police officer, and I've been a police officer for 19 years now. When I started out, all you needed was a high school diploma, and what I did is I spent 4 years in the military, and I got out and I got myself a job as a police officer. Now the kids coming in that want to be a police officer, they're having to have a 4-year degree. So where I was able to say make $50,000 in the military in 4 years, and then I was ready to start my new job as a police officer, a kid now, he's $50,000 in the hole. Right from the get go. I guess my question is, has that become in other fields? Is that a common theme where you need this degree to get this job where 20 years ago you didn't?
Andre, we're going to get an answer for you. I'm just going to ask that you, as you listen, just stay on the line for us if you would. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Jen, what do you think?
Absolutely. So my own dad is a firefighter, and he had a similar trajectory of military and firefighting. And he always says that at the time, nobody wanted that job. Hmm. But now everybody wants to be a firefighter or a police officer because, you know, it's one of the few remaining jobs that without a college degree, you can still hope to support a family, buy a house, you get health insurance and a good pension. And I found that there was an incredible amount of competition among mostly the men that I spoke with, where they knew that these firefighting, police, government jobs were really their only chance at a stable future without a college degree, or even with one, you know, they're still their best shot. And that actually created a lot of anxiety and a lot of tension as they competed for these jobs. And for sure, everyone needed to go to the military in order to get hired in these jobs as well.
We have an email here from Heather who says, my husband and I got married last year and are in our early 30s. We're so grateful to have each other, but even with both of us working, we're not able to achieve that dream we all had growing up. We can barely afford rent and have now ended up living with my parents. Do you see people our age, Heather asks, finally being able to achieve home ownership in the future, or will we be barely getting by in the long term?
That's a great question. I mean, some of the few people in my sample who were able to buy houses ended up having them repossessed because they, you know, didn't understand the interest rates mm-hmm. and ended up not being able to make the mortgage payments. So I think it's very scary and risky. I think especially for the people I spoke with who will probably not be in stable partnerships, it's very hard to imagine them being able to afford to buy a house or a mortgage. And it seems like that might be one piece of the American dream that feels increasingly out of reach. It's just too risky.
Of course, we always have to be careful about generalizing in a subject such as this. But do you feel that these young adults were in some way failed by their parents or the adults who were supposed to have been raising them and making sure they had the necessary skills to eventually be out on their own?
Well, I think that their own parents didn't really have that skill, those skills and knowledge to give them, mm-hmm. Especially, you know, the parents who were able to make it with a high school degree, who were able to get a job as a mail carrier or a house painter or a firefighter and, you know, support their kids. They don't really have that knowledge that their children need to get by to go to college and enter a professional and knowledge-based economy. And what's interesting is that, you know, when I think about people I know from the middle or upper classes, even their parents don't always have that knowledge. But, you know, they can hire a college coach or rely on a friend to help their kid. So it's very hard to, you know what the right path is in our very competitive economy.
I think a lot of people think of, you know, young adulthood as a time when even if you are not especially close to your family of origin, friends sort of become a family. It sounds like that is not the case to such a strong degree with these adults that you spoke with.
It really was more of a story of being betrayed by people close to them. So maybe they would invest a lot in a relationship only to be kind of betrayed in the end, whether by a roommate who, you know, didn't pay their rent or, I mean, so many examples of just feeling like people let them down mm-hmm. and then not wanting to invest further in relationships.
You mentioned earlier that something that some of these individuals have struggled with is substance use or abuse. Can you talk about how that finds its way into their lives and how that sort of complicates any efforts to, live productively?
Sure. Yeah. So many of them would talk about how they never, growing up, they never really had a five-year plan. They never really had goals or hopes. They had kind of given up on their future. And they'd talk about, you know, turning to drugs and alcohol or, you know, substance abuse as a way to kind of cope or forget. Or maybe it's something they even learned from their families or from people around them. However, many of them were able to kind of turn this substance abuse narrative into one of redemption. So they would talk about a moment where they realized that they were ruining their lives, or they realized that, you know, maybe they did have a painful childhood and that's why they were drinking, but that didn't mean that they should just give up on their life. And they'd turn their life around. They might start going to AA or reading self-help books, and they tell a story of being strong and overcoming that addiction and being able to think about the future, you know, as long as they stay sober. So in some ways, that goal becomes like the one thing in their life they can control, even when they maybe can't control their jobs or they don't have any money or they're not in a relationship.
Jen, when your subjects allow themselves to dream about their, you know, the job they would love to have, was the primary benefit of that that it would pay enough to give them sort of a decent middle class lifestyle? Or were they also looking beyond that to think about sort of quality of life and the way they felt about the work they were doing?
So they would generally, and it's funny because they use pretty vague terms, almost as if they couldn't imagine what they could hope for. Hmm. So they would talk about, oh, maybe I would wear a suit every day, or maybe I would own things. I don't own anything. Maybe I could own a car. So it was pretty simple, the things that they dreamed about. They weren't dreaming about being very wealthy. And, you know, most of them liked work. They liked to work hard. You know, they took satisfaction out of their serving job. So, you know, what they really wanted was to have a sense of stability so they knew they could count on that job mm-hmm. and to maybe own a few things. That's what they're hoping for.
My guest is Jennifer M. Silva. She's a postdoctoral fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School and author of the new book, Coming Up Short, Working Class Adulthood in an Age of Uncertainty. We'll come back to the conversation, take more of your calls and emails after this short break. You can get on the line to join us by phoning 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Jennifer M. Silva, who is a postdoctoral fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School and joins us from studios on the campus of Harvard University. Her new book is called Coming Up Short, Working Class Adulthood in an Age of Uncertainty. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. And that is where we hear now from Frank in DeSoto. Hello, Frank.
Hello. I'm so glad you have Ms. DeSilver in. I'd like to ask her to sort of make a comment. I've been a scholar. I'm an African-American scholar, and what she's describing seems to be the entry of the vulnerability of the white working class to what African-Americans, lower and working class, have had for years. And African-Americans have had some things that have helped us a little bit on the adjustments, i.e. some of the historically black colleges. And I was wondering why her church, the institution, sometimes the black church, though it's much less effective now than it used to be. Are the institutions, the Catholic Church or other things that are not there for to step into some of the gaps? It doesn't step into all the gaps because the African-American community is even worse now. But they get symbolic benefits from an Obama election, but the conditions continue to get worse. But the community itself is sort of used to adjusting to these things, which these structural things which American society says are due to individual fallacies, which the white working class continues to buy, but I'm not so sure the black working class is bought.
Really interesting. Thanks for your call, Frank.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point. And one of the findings that really struck me was that the communities and the neighborhoods and the organizations that these young adults are growing up into are very weak or they're not there. So people don't really talk about having grown up going to church or having seen their parents participate in a community or really even having anyone around them, you know, like a teacher or a pastor who they could turn to for help. And so there isn't really the sense of an institution as a safety net that can kind of, you know, catch them if they fall or can launch them into the future. They have a much bigger sense of having to do it on their own. And for the black respondents I spoke with, there maybe was a stronger sense of religiosity, but at the same time, the communities they were in also didn't seem maybe as strong as they would have been a generation ago. And there really was a sense of kind of self-blame or I have to make it on my own or a lack of solidarity among both black and white respondents.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we have Nelson in Colleyville. Hey, Nelson.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Hi, I was just calling to give a little insight from my experiences as a child of two working parents. They were both full-time workers, and they never really pushed me to go to college, but I eventually did go to a community college. And like there was a caller earlier, he mentioned something about it being more economical. But there is some truth to that, because now going into a four-year university, there is a lot more funding for students who have received an associate's degree and are going to a four-year university. But like I was saying, my parents, they never really had me focused on going to college. So I never really knew how I would go into it. But going to a two-year university or college, it really helped out.
Thanks so much for your call. Any thoughts on that, Jen?
I think that's great. It's a story of institutions working, and I think we could imagine maybe revamping our community college system in a way that did offer, you know, guidance to more young adults.
So you write in the book that your mom and dad decided, like, when you were born, they sort of, you know, shook hands and said, this will be the first person in our family to graduate from college. And I apparently that was true. Things have gone well for you. Have you been able to identify the differences between your working class upbringing and that of the people that you studied who seem to be having a much harder time of it?
That's a great question. You know, I think for me, I would have to look at the kinds of community-based institutions that really worked for me. I was lucky to grow up in a small town where, you know, my family knew everyone. I had both sets of grandparents there who had also lived there almost their whole lives. And, you know, I was always very close to my teachers, some of whom had even taught my parents. And also, you know, I had a lot of friends whose parents were doctors or lawyers who kind of took me under their wing and could be counted on for guidance. So I think I was very lucky to have a support system where I could, you know, find out information about college tours, which my parents might not have known as much about. It was kind of in the water.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Lewis in Dallas. Hi, Lewis.
Hey, how you doing? I appreciate this opportunity.
Sure.
My question was similar to the, or statement similar to the gentleman that called previously. I was wondering, was there any correlation between these kids' faith or lack of faith in terms of their religious background that she may have correlated in context of these kids reaching their adulthood goals and dreams?
Thanks for your call. You want to address that in some more detail?
Sure. So I would say that the more religious respondents who tended in my sample to be African-Americans and African-American women, they would have a little bit less of this sense of I have to do everything on my own. Adulthood is about overcoming my own issues, and a little bit more of a sense of I'll become an adult in God's time, mm-hmm. or, you know, leave it up to God. It'll happen, you know, when he's ready for it to happen, which I think could be very comforting. And at the same time, it was sort of less divisive. So many of the young men and women who embraced this attitude of, you know, I'm going to do it on my own. My parents failed me. I'm angry at other people. I want to cut them out of my life. There was less of that among the religious respondents. They were more likely to try to retain ties, even if they'd been disappointed by family members. And I think that was because of their faith.
Did any of them seem to have sort of big dreams that struck you as maybe admirable but really unlikely? I mean, I'm wondering about, for those that did continue to have some optimism about their future and their potential, did their dreams strike you as realistic and achievable?
And for many of them, it was like they'd almost mock themselves for having dreams in the first place. Hmm. Or I'd say to them, you know, can you remember when you were little, what did you want to be when you grow up? Which is a common question for children.
Yeah.
And they'd say things like, I wanted to be a Ninja Turtle, or I wanted to be a ballerina, which are things that, you know, maybe all kids think, but it seemed like it never was realized into a more concrete plan, whether because they didn't think it was possible for them or they didn't even know what the options were.
You know, it's interesting when you said earlier that they, when they talked about what they might like to do in the immediate future, they said, I'd like to wear a suit to work or that sort of thing. That reminds me of kind of a pre-adolescent vision of work rather than one that is informed by, you know, maybe, you know, help throughout school of, to, you know, toward figuring out what sort of career one might want.
Yeah, it's like an image. They have an image of a suit. Maybe they see it on TV, but they don't sit at dinner talking with their parents about, you know, what does a lawyer do every day or what does a doctor do every day? It's true.
Back to the phones now. This time on the line, we have Grace in Plano. Hi, Grace.
Hey, thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
So I guess I want to change my question since it was kind of asked before, but I'm the daughter of immigrants. Both my parents came from Taiwan, but I know, in a sense, we have this, you know, I have this advantage because both of them were educated, and there was always that unspoken expectation that, of course, you're going to college. And I'm just curious because for a lot of these, because you said earlier that a lot of these, my peers in age have lost their faith in, like, institutions which have betrayed them. I'm just curious if they, like, found anything new to be loyal to in your conversation that you had with them, like, if they're finding, if they're actually getting more grounded in their history, because I found that I've gotten a lot more invested in understanding my own history, not just of my family, but who I am given my race, class, and gender in this country.
That's really interesting. Thanks so much for your call.
That is interesting. And I would say that the people I spoke with did tend to focus more on their self. You know, they wanted to kind of encourage the realization of their true self, figure out who I really am, you know, despite the obstacles I've faced or despite what others think of me. I want to develop my true self and cultivate that, whether it's through art or writing stories or listening to music. But it wasn't really a sense of self grounded in, you know, their class or race or gender. It was a much more individualized narrative of finding myself. And in fact, they're sort of hostile to the idea that who they are would be defined by, you know, their gender or their race. They embrace this ideology of individualism and, you know, nothing's going to stop me but me.
So, Jen, as a society, we are not well served by having a significant portion of an entire generation feeling sort of hopeless, struggling to get by in what could be, you know, the ramp up to the most productive years of their working lives. Did you reach any conclusions about what society needs to pay attention to, where the fixes might be, what the limitations are of our ability to assist people that we may not know personally, but on a societal level?
That is a great question. I wish I had a really good answer for it. I think it would have to be a multi-part solution that was, you know, maybe involving government or economics, as well as, you know, communities and neighborhoods down to individual families. And I think we'd need to focus on, first of all, giving these young adults some guidance and support. So a basic level of stability where they're not worrying about where they're going to live the next day, but also an idea of what the future could hold. So what kinds of jobs exist? You know, what kind of skills and knowledge do I need? you know, could they even talk to a person who held that job so they could learn more about it? And I think also maybe some kind of safety net to catch them if they fell. So, you know, there are examples of people who maybe fell and cut themselves and went into so much debt that they then were afraid to take loans for school. Hmm. And also people who just who make mistakes, you know, whether it is like a addiction problem and who then pay a very high price for it, which, you know, sets them back. So maybe having someone there to help them turn their life around.
It is interesting that once people sort of come of age at 18, as a society, we've decided, like, you're cut off. You know, like any special right. help is over now.
Right. But really, they're just beginning, right? They've left high school. They maybe have left their parents and they're launching into their new life. And so I think, you know, if we think about traditional adulthood, you know, getting married, getting a stable job, having kids, it really is the entry into institutions, you know, a lifelong marriage, maybe a church or a club or, you know, a family. And now it seems like there isn't really this entry into lifelong institutions. Mm-hmm. People are really more on their own. And so I think trying to think about what kinds of institutions we can build that will, you know, nurture and support people as they become productive citizens.
Was there a pattern at all to the kinds of experiences that most of your respondents had in K-12 education? I mean, had most of them done all right in school, had pretty positive experiences, or was it sort of a mixed bag?
You know, education was probably the main source of experiences of bewilderment and betrayal. Hmm. So the sense of approaching education thinking that their teachers would help them or give them the tools they needed to succeed, but feeling left behind or looked over. Some would complain that, you know, maybe they'd had ADHD and hadn't been diagnosed and thought they were stupid their whole lives and then, you know, never thought they could go to college. Or getting in fights and being written off and thinking they were an idiot. So it was generally seen as a more hostile space where they didn't fit in and didn't have the right knowledge to succeed rather than a place that could help them.
So having completed this research and come to what is, frankly, a rather bleak conclusion, what's the next thing you want to study? Where do you want to take this knowledge that you've gained and apply it?
So I would like to continue building this bigger picture of working class life. I'm so intrigued by the theme of distrust and betrayal in institutions that I heard over and over again. And so I'd like to see how that translates into politics. Hmm. So how does, you know, this lack of faith in institutions, does that make people vote? And how does it make them vote? Or does it make them withdraw completely? And I think that would have some big consequences for the country.
Did you actually ask any questions about political participation?
Yes, and there was actually very little belief in the system or participation among the sample.
Jennifer M. Silva is a postdoctoral fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School. She joined us today from studios on the campus of Harvard University. Her new book is called Coming Up Short, Working Class Adulthood in an Age of Uncertainty. Jen, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can download the podcast free and learn more about the show and upcoming programs at kera.org/think. If you'd like to send a comment, question, or suggestion along, you can email it to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.